You're listening to The Promise of Personalized Medicine, brought to you by AccessDx. This is a show for the lab professionals and medical directors who bring forward novel diagnostic tests to advance modern medicine. Let's dive into the conversation.
Bruce, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. Been looking forward to hearing from you for a while now, so thank you.
Well, thanks for the chance to be here.
Absolutely. So let's just jump right into it. What is personalized medicine to you?
I think of personalized medicine as using genomics or other biomarkers to improve healthcare. And I realize, of course, it's anything in the sense that the patient personally wants. But I think when we talk about it professionally, we're talking about biomarkers, genomics, things like that.
Great. And then what would you say in the last 10 years, especially some of the advances that have helped the whole personalized medicine diagnostic industry move forward?
Well, I think it's the things that have had the biggest impact is the way I'd answer that question. And I think it's cancer oncogenes that directly assign to specific therapies, so that ALK fusions and the Zelcori drug, things like that. I think that's been hugely impactful. That's also an area that's closely FDA regulated, meets FDA standards for clinical trials and so on, and has clear outcomes data. The other area would probably be, after that, NIPT testing, which revolutionized that aspect of having children. NIPT was adopted fairly rapidly, fairly broadly, and really impactful.
Yeah, NIPT really has been a success story, hasn't it, for us over the last 10 years?
Yeah, and it makes a good case study. There was a very clear use scenario. It wasn't anything vague about when and how you'd use it. It was clearly replacing something else, so there was a clear one-to-one advantages versus its competitor, which is giving everybody amniocentesis, and the cost factors were similar or lower than the conventional cost, meaning amniocentesis. So it was sort of a trifecta of three clear questions with three clear answers.
Yeah. In addition to that, Bruce, it kind of showed how when industry works together, because they form coalitions or associations to kind of promote everybody rather than just a single company. And I thought that was a good example of how we all can work together.
Well, and I think they were also could be backed into that, because it was to the common good. But the products, although not identical, were probably viewed by health plans and technology assessments as relatively similar. So it made sense in that situation to be in a coalition.
Yeah, that makes sense. Going from a positive NIPT commercialization effort to the next question, which really is, what are some of the challenges that continue to remain and industry continues to struggle with?
Well, I think of four. The field seems to be very capital intensive. When you look at some of the smaller companies, which would be more like a startup, smaller companies that have public financials like Castle Bioscience or Biodesix, it's a very capital intensive field. And you very often find companies that have $20 or $30 million of revenue, which means they've got a significant footprint in the market. And they have $60 or $90 or $100 million of expenses. So it's very capital consuming or capital intensive. The post-delivery costs are high. You either don't get paid or you spend half the money trying to get paid in appeals and problems like that. I think the second factor that's a challenge that may be underappreciated is the timelines. Even our big success stories like NIPT or NIPS, those took certainly several years to be well adopted and get codes and things like that. And for many tests, it drags on for quite a few years, could easily be a timeline that doubles what the founder's expectations were. So being prepared for that timeline, and you add that together with being capital intensive, it's kind of a toxic combination. Then I would say the third thing is defining use cases. So having a clear use case, who gets this, when do they get it, why do they get it, why do they benefit from it? Where again, the cancer drugs with genes or NIPT, clear answers to those questions. But I still see either companies have a hard time defining what they're trying to do, or they're picking something that is very hard to explain, or they don't explain well what their advantages are versus other things. And I was just working with a year-long client yesterday and reviewing some drafts of payer materials they were presenting. And when you got towards the clinical utility part, the writing fell apart, the paragraphs didn't flow together, some of the sentences in the paragraphs didn't make sense. So there's something about explaining what your advantages are and why that often, and this was an outstanding company. I mean, the many other performance things, they just knock it out of the park, you know, 5 out of 5. But when it got to this part of a dossier explaining clinical utility, it just melted. And the other thing, the last thing I'd mentioned that I've worked a lot on, I focus on the Medicare program and how it works and how it adapts to new technology. But there is this sort of valley of death between getting Medicare coverage and getting broader coverage in a wider insured population, which is an area, of course, that you've worked on with how to pay for tests and how to get appeals and stuff like that for years. But I call that a valley of death between Medicare and the next 20 payers.
I love that valley of death because you're right. I mean, it could be, and it generally is, a few years, if not more, for a lot of companies to go from Medicare coverage to, we'll call, widespread commercial adoption. And then, like you said earlier, Bruce, it's kind of like, well, can you survive those 2 or 3 years in that interim, especially if you've gone out to the market and said, oh, we're ready to go, in unrealistic expectations as far as being able to get physicians, one, not only to order the test, but more importantly, to order it appropriately, and then those tests getting paid for.
And that's why people try to pick niches, you know, where there are only 150 doctors in the U.S. prescribe half the patients or things like that. You know, those, our marketing costs will be smaller, or all the patients are in one place, or it's mainly at academic medical centers. You know, any way that kind of carves down this huge field of patients and this huge field of payers.
I'll go back to NIPT testing also, because you said clear use case. And it was interesting. I really don't know if it was intentional or just the way that it happened, but going after the high-risk population initially and then expanding its indication gradually into average risk, that's difficult because you have to sell internally because all of a sudden your market shrinks if you're only going for high risk. And a lot of companies are unwilling to do that.
Yeah, in the case of NIPT, I think they were following in the footsteps of the existing guidelines, you know, women over 40 or whatever the criteria were at the time. So I think there was a template that would have been pretty hard to avoid coming out of the gate.
Which is good when you're trying to follow the standard of care, the agreed upon process, if you will, and not kind of go down a different road. Because, you know, my opinion is healthcare, it does not like disruption. You know, there's too many people involved in which it, once a disruption occurs, it impacts them, which they think adversely.
Sure it does. I've never forgotten, it's actually a case study that's a little outside of lab medicine, but 10 years ago, Medicare was looking at whether to cover virtual colonography as a method of colon cancer screening, where you do a CT scan and you sort of fly through the colon and you can look for small, you know, tumors. At this public meeting, the American Radiology Association, American College of Radiology, was very strongly in favor of this technology, felt it had come none too soon, it had to be adopted quickly and would be very big health benefits. The American College of Gastroenterology, who do colonoscopies, were the next speaker. And they were gravely concerned this wasn't well established, had a lot of unanticipated risks. It would be a serious problem and should not move forward. So you could see where people's talks lined up versus what they were doing, radiology versus colonoscopies. And that happens in other areas too. You know, our blood test will replace this expensive surgery, or our blood test will replace this PET scan.
That's right. That's right. Always have to watch out for how it affects the various folks involved directly or indirectly, right?
Sure.
When we talk about personalized medicine and diagnostics and gaining appropriate coverage, how do you think industry should work with health plans or consider to work with health plans? What have we done well? What should we do differently?
Sure. I think that health plans have felt kind of overrun with a proliferation of new diagnostics and maybe 2 out of 3 without a proper use case or a full validation. They're exposed to, you know, pressures that they don't want to be exposed to. So I think having an unclear language or too complicated language, not having a clear story, and then the poor diagnostics companies are confronted with 5 or 10 or more payers that they have to try and deal with and getting meetings is difficult, let alone the person on the other side of the table understands what you're delivering or has time to absorb it. So I think that it's naturally a fairly difficult relationship between the diagnostics industry and payers. And of course, the diagnostics industry, startup company might have one test to worry about, where the payer's got, 12 million patients and $300 billion of healthcare and 30,000 CPT codes. So they have very unfocused attention relative to the particular device company or your diagnostics.
Yeah, and trying to get their attention for my one little test is difficult at times, right? And then a lot of the health plans have gone ahead and outsourced that area of expertise to lab benefit management companies, right? Where they ask the LBM to at least take the initial assessment and write policy on their behalf. So how do you think that LBMs have assisted with this whole process from a diagnostic innovator's point of view?
I hear a lot of frustration from my clients. I tend to work with them up to the point of Medicare coverage. So that's really where my focus is and where I've got the brightest lights and most details of seeing what's happening, or seeing too many details of what's happening. In principle, bringing some of that judgment into one place and consolidating it, it's a natural thing to outsource. Why would 30 health plans try to even attempt to go through the same piles of material and the same tests when it can be read and summarized in one place or three or four places? So I think the basic economics, it's a kind of need that can be outsourced, is good. But it would go back to what I was saying earlier, that we don't always have a good language for comparing tests, comparing outcomes, or comparing different kinds of services, some of which are diagnostic tests, some are surgeries or PET scans. So you either get sort of confusing discussions of evaluating the test, or you get very, wide disagreements and disparate decisions.
Just to let everyone know, we are going to have a diagnostic conference event September 28th in Manhattan Beach, California, where we'll bring industry leaders together, and we're going to bring the health plan folks and LBM representatives to the occasion also, where we can have live Q&A sessions with a panel of medical directors. And I think the more that as an industry we can come alongside these individuals, that we can make headway. So look forward to seeing you all there. Thanks again. And, since you do a lot of work with Medicare, if you look at the MolDX program, do you think the LBM is just kind of the commercial response to MolDX?
I'd say something very close to what you just said. I think it's an analogy to MolDX, or serving the same purpose as MolDX. I don't know if it's a response to MolDX, but the people at MolDX, the Medicare specialty program, they have been saying for a couple of years, they want to commercialize their Z codes. They want to commercialize their technology assessments. They want to license intellectual property, which hard to me, it seems like it's some diffusion of attention of the management. It's like if I had 10 clients instead of five, I'd be diffused, I'd miss deadlines, and they're talking about commercializing intellectual property. And then you've got new customers and new customer needs and new services, sales cycles. The MolDX, I think, wants to play in some of the same ponds as the LBNs. So it works both ways.
Yeah. As you know, with MolDX going ahead and licensing the Z codes to Optum, now you have Optum that's going to be integrating Z codes on behalf of all their clients. So, and that whole test identifier, whether it's a Z code or a GTU code from Concert, for the past 10 years, we've all struggled with, hey, I need to identify myself so that the payer understands what's being done, so that they can make a determination as far as, yes, I want to cover it and this is how much I'll pay, or I don't want to cover it. So where do you think the whole test identifier will go down the... I'm asking you to look into your crystal ball now for test identifiers.
Well, I think it continues to have momentum, but will probably progress more slowly than people expect. There's that old saying that people overestimate short-term change, but underestimate long-term change. So if you think Z-codes will be all over in 6 months, that was ambiguous, will be all over the place in 6 months. No. How much could they be all over the place in 6 years? Well, maybe very much. So I think that train has momentum. the problem with, it's not exactly the problem with C-codes. There's a lot that C-codes don't do. So when you're making a patient coverage decision or a, you know, personalized prior authorization decision, you know, the Z code only tells you stuff about the test. You know, here's the limit of detection, and these are the names of the 16 genes that it tests. They don't tell you, you know, is this patient 60 or 80? Does this patient have prior surgery or not? Does this patient fail or succeed on which drugs in the past? I mean, they don't tell you, you know, you still need to know lots of things. It's like the old saying that the guy looks for his key under the searchlight, under the street lamp, because that's where there's a pool of light and everything else is dark. So, I mean, the Z code will tell you that you have these 16 genes or these 41 genes and which exons and which parts of which exons, but it tells you nothing about the rest of that black yard, right? Where the patient is, where the past history is, where the medical choices are. So, you know, Z codes only do so much. Well,
I love that.
And I heard the MolDX management sort of refer to what I just said on a call, a webinar a couple of weeks ago. The Z code only takes you so far. It's, you know, endless amounts of detail out into the decimal points about one aspect of the patient's problem.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a good name, but I'm going to look it up on GoDaddy, Streetlight Diagnostics.
Ha, that would be good. Yeah.
We only focus our efforts right here. That's it. Nothing else.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
good. So as we've talked about test identifiers and just health plans and their struggle, if you will, with, I guess, maybe not accepting, because I think if you talk to most health planning executives, they'll say, sure, we want personalized medicine. It's just a matter of how we get there, right? Because they have different wants and desires and risk tolerance, and industry has theirs, right? They want stuff done. We all want stuff done in 2 years, where the insurance is kind of like, you know, if this takes 6 years for adoption, that's what it takes. I'm in no rush here because the spotlight's very narrow and I got to make sure that my members are being taken care of. So what do you think are the challenges that health plans have, or do they even consider them challenges when it comes to personalized medicine?
So the challenges they feel is being sort of overwhelmed. I mean, and then the MolDX program, which is one payer, you know, back to the Medicare program, they have a very high volume. They almost always feel somewhat underfunded being a government program. They deal with complex issues. So, you know, producing high quality writing and high quality decisions is very hard and it's time consuming. I think one of the things that's different about diagnostic sales, or maybe this would be other medical devices, you know, it's different than other kinds of B2C or B2B sales. If you're doing a B2C sale, you know what you're selling into. You know, I mean, the person's going to get this great meal, they're going to get this nice sweater, they're going to get this new car, they're going to buy this house or rent that apartment. So it's a B2C. But even B2B, you know, you're selling to people that are actually going to use it. You're selling a new IT system to the CFO. You're selling a new cybersecurity system to the CFO. So he and his people are actually using the thing they're buying. And when you pivot to insurance, know that the Blue Cross is not using bracket tests or Decipher prostate tests or whatever else. So you completely lose that aspect of any normal sale, B2C or B2B, where you're actually selling people that have a direct interest in it. The payer has a quite indirect interest, or the decision maker has a quite indirect interest in what's going on.
Which is very unique to healthcare, is it not?
Yeah, I think so. It's probably one of our basic problems.
And to overcome that, really, part of the issue is to understand that, first of all, and then, you know, going back to the basics as far as like, okay, from an insurance company's standpoint, what is it they want or don't want, right? They don't like to be surprised, right? So the more that you can educate them and give them a time horizon that is what they would consider appropriate, I think is crucial. I think that is one mistake that we do as an industry. We kind of come in and say, here I am, and, you know, why don't you cover me and my test? And they're like, well, who are you? And why should I be interested? So yeah. I think starting earlier is a good tactic and strategy for some companies.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, we really appreciate everything that you've done for just kind of putting the spotlight on the industry and helping us grow so that we get not only coverage with Medicare, but just further adoption from a commercial standpoint. Your blogs and all the information that you put out there for all of us to take in is greatly appreciated. I just want to let you know that. So thank you once again for joining us, and we really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Perry.
You've been listening to The Promise of Personalized Medicine, produced by Amplify Podcasts, and original music by Jake Demas. To ensure that you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast player. And if you like what you've heard, we would love to hear from you with a rating or a review. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.